And joining us on the book club on Perspectives today are Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek. They are the authors of the book Indianapolis, the true story of the worst sea disaster in the U.S. naval history and the 50-year fight to exonerate an innocent man. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Now, first of all, before we start, with your permission, I would like to read the opening paragraph, because that really grabbed me from the beginning. And I read the book and I also listened to the audio version. And it's just so descriptive, this first paragraph. It's just incredible and I really love it. So with your permission, I'd like to read that.
Sure.
Okay. She was born from soil as American as the men who sailed her, ore or mine near the Great Lakes and in the Tennessee Valley, transported by barge and train to steel mills in Detroit and Pittsburgh, machined and welded and hammered together in Camden, New Jersey, by tradesmen from across the 48 states. From her keel, forged red-hot and laid in 1930, she rose amid clang and clamor and showering sparks, unfolding bow to stern in 147 bands of high-strength steel, her superstructure climbing toward the sun until, in 1932, she parted water for the first time and was christened USS Indianapolis. That pretty much describes the fact that this ship belonged to everybody in the U.S. because it had a piece of everything and everyone from the U.S. Tell us about how you came about writing that paragraph and opening it up in 1932 when it was first being christened as the USS Indianapolis.
One of the things that we wanted to do, Louis, in this story was really bring USS Indianapolis to life. For over 70 years, she'd been known as a sinking story, a disaster tale, a shark tale, and we wanted to remind everyone that this was a great and storied ship. She was the flagship of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Admiral Raymond Spruance stood on her bridge and strategized and conquered many of the islands leading from Pearl Harbor to the home islands of Japan on USS Indianapolis. So we wanted to remind people of that, and we felt like the best way to do that was really take readers back to the ship's very beginnings.
I got a little bit ahead of myself, I think, because I was so excited about that first paragraph and wanted to let our listeners hear that. But I want to talk a little bit about both of you. Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek, they have devoted more than a decade to researching and reporting the story of this book, the USS Indianapolis. Lynn is a U.S. Navy veteran and longtime journalist, is the number one New York Times bestselling author of 11 nonfiction books with more than 16 million copies in print. She lives in San Diego. And Sarah is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and one of the world's leading experts on Indianapolis. She has published new research on the ship and Proceedings, the flagship journal of the U.S. Naval Institute, and she lives in San Marcos, California. Let's start, first of all, with you, Lynn. Tell us a little bit about your background. Have you always been interested in writing?
I have always been interested in writing. I started writing in the fifth grade, actually, short stories and romance novels in those little spiral-bound notebooks, but where my friend, who was also writing at the time that I was, she would finish her novels, and I would never finish mine, and I realized at that time, or actually later, that I just hadn't found my genre yet. So what attracted me in later years was narrative nonfiction, and in 1998, I started writing for World Magazine, which is at the time was a national news weekly. It's a biweekly now. But even as I was reporting on news and politics and culture and world events, I really found myself drawn to long-form narrative nonfiction. So I started writing books in 2005, and here I am a dozen books later, working with my wonderful partner, Sarah Vladek.
Now, two of your best-known titles, I guess, are same kind of different, and Heaven is for Real, which became a movie and turned into a movie. And tell us a little bit about what went into both of those books.
Well, both of those books were collaborations. So, you know, for your readers who are listening, when you see a byline that says, by so-and-so, with so-and-so, that means that the with was the writer who actually wrote the words and formulated the story on paper, and the person who is the by author was the person who had a story to tell but wasn't a writer by profession. So with Same Kind of Different as Me, I connected with a wealthy art dealer named Ron Hall, who lived in Fort Worth, Texas, and with his friend Denver Moore, who was a homeless former sharecropper. And so in that book, I told their story of racial reconciliation and compassion and poverty fighting. And then that became a movie which was released, I believe, last year. And then with Heaven is for Real, I connected in the same way with the Burpo family, who were from Imperial, Nebraska, and told the story of Colton Burpo, who was a little boy who had a near-death experience and came back with stories of heaven.
You are also, as I mentioned at the beginning, a Navy veteran. When you were serving our country, and thank you for that, were there talks or were there already something in the back of your mind about the Indianapolis?
At that time, no. I was actually not in a black shoe, as we would say, in the seagoing Navy. I was what we call an Airedale or a brown shoe, so I was an air traffic controller. My husband did serve aboard several ships and retired as a senior chief, so I did have, you know, a lot of familiarity with naval history and customs and protocol and so forth. And so when I connected with Sarah on USS Indianapolis, I had all that background to assist us.
We are visiting with Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek. They are the authors of the book Indianapolis, The True Story of the Worst Sea Disaster in U.S. Naval History and the 50-Year Fight to Exonerate an Innocent Man. Now, Sarah, in the book, it's mentioned, I think it's actually afterwards in the audiobook that I heard, the fact that you were very interested in this since you were 13. You were watching something with your dad.
Yes, I was watching a documentary with my dad, and they reduced the story of the Indianapolis to a single line, which was she was the ship that carried the bomb and was sunk. And I thought, how could something so important have so little information about it? And I think that was the initial draw, is that there was just nothing about such an important mission. And, you know, I always thought, someone will tell the story before I'm old enough. But no one did. And that just really, it always kind of stuck with me. It was something I thought was just a very intriguing story. And at that point, I didn't even know the half of it. I just knew it, as most people do, as a sinking story, you know, later saw it as the monologue in Jaws. And I knew there had to be more to it. And so in 2001, I reached out to the survivors of the sinking, and they introduced me to the group and invited me to my first reunion. And that's really when I got to know the whole story of the Indianapolis and the fact that, you know, it was a crew of teenagers. You know, these weren't career military, they were citizens that were farmers, and they had just survived the Depression, and just young kids from across the country, and they went to serve during wartime. And it just, the heroism, the individual stories of what built up this Navy in World War II was just so fascinating that I realized I wanted to tell the story. And in 2003, they asked me, the survivors of the Indianapolis asked me to be their storyteller.
One of the things you just mentioned, the movie Jaws, and I remember watching that movie when I was, well, still a young lad, and it's something that, you know, was very intriguing. It was scary, you know, sitting at the edge of your seat. But it was not until I read the book, your book, and it mentioned another book, In Harm's Way, that it talked a little bit about the Jaws. And if you wouldn't mind refreshing the memory of our listeners and perhaps viewers who saw that movie about that.
Yeah, there's a scene, a monologue that's done by Robert Shaw, who, you know, plays the character of Quint. Or the shark is attacking Amity, and they get this shark hunter who comes in and helps them. And what Spielberg is quoted as saying is they really knew they had a movie after this monologue was done filming. And what he talks about is the fact that he was a survivor of the Indianapolis and what it was like in those waters and how terrifying it was when the shark came after you and you didn't know if it was going to get you or the man next to you. And so he kind of devoted his life to shark hunting after this, and hence that's why he went on to kill Jaws. So it's just this captivating scene, and, you know, there's a couple facts that are a little bit off, but truly it captures the spirit of what most of the survivors felt and the fear and what they were left with for the rest of their lives because of the sharks.
And in the book, you talk about how you were, you know, carrying on and deciding, what am I going to do? But all of a sudden, it seems like Lynn just kind of dropped into your life and you all collaborated.
I wish it were that easy. I mean, it was really providential how it all took place. At that time, we were working on developing a movie, and I had written a screenplay, a series actually, and kind of in the style of Band of Brothers, and took it to a major network. And at that point, they had said, this is fantastic, but it needs to be based on a book. And my background is filmmaking and screenwriting. So I really didn't know how to write a book. They're very, very different. And kind of reached out to family, friends, and everyone I knew to say, hey, anyone know how to write a book or know any authors that I can talk to? You know, a broad question. And turns out my mother-in-law actually had Lynn speak during her book club. And through friends connected us. And Lynn kind of tells this story better than I do, I have to say. But I wanted advice. And, you know, meanwhile, I did not know at the time, you know, other than I didn't know Lynn's background in the Navy, but I didn't know she had been praying for a project of this nature, of an epic World War II story. So when I called asking, I wanted advice, and, you know, she wanted to write the story with me. I think that's the Cliff Notes version of this, but, you know, what came out of this was this incredible partnership and one of my best friends, and we have way more fun than you should have during work. you know, we're very, very blessed to get to do this together, and it was an incredible journey, and I'd say, yeah, in that way, it just fell into my lap.
Did you want to add anything, Lynn?
Well, I joke that in 2011, when Sarah emailed me and then we had a phone call and I learned that she had the desire to write this epic, iconic World War II story, I had been literally praying, because I do pray about my work and asking God to lead me to an iconic World War II story. And here, out of the blue, quote-unquote, I get this phone call and email. But my problem was is that she was only asking for advice. And so I joked that I thought, how can I manipulate this young lady into letting me help her?
At the beginning of the book, as I mentioned, you talk about the christening of the ship, and then how, in 1932 is when it was christened. But then later on, you talk about what President Harry Truman wanted the ship to do. If you wouldn't mind carrying us through that.
You're referring to the transport of the atomic bomb component?
Yeah, yes.
Yes. Well, this was just an amazing story that Sarah and I ran across in our research, because in researching the book, we, as I mentioned before, we wanted to expand out from the sinking and the survival story and really tell the whole story of USS Indianapolis. So that our research took us to the Library of Congress, to the National Archives, Naval War College, and on. At the Library of Congress, we were blessed to run across the personal papers of an Army major named Robert Furman. Furman was the head of intelligence for the entire Manhattan Project. He worked directly for General Leslie Groves, and by 1945, there was no one in the world who knew more about more aspects of the Manhattan Project and this super secretive American development of the atomic bomb than Robert Furman. And in those papers that we found in the Library of Congress were his personal accountings, his notes that he jotted contemporaneously with transporting the bomb, and then stories that he wrote afterwards about what it was like to go aboard Indianapolis with those fissionable components, and about the men and the officers that he got to know. And what happened was is that Harry Truman, in mid-July of 1945, while still deciding whether they were actually going to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, decided to have the fissionable components transported to Tinian Island in the Mariana Islands, and Indianapolis was selected for that job. So on July 16, 1945, they left Hunter's Point, which is near San Francisco, made a speed run to Pearl Harbor, which was a record-setting run at 74.5 hours, and then they refueled and headed for Tinian Island, and that's where they dropped off components of the atomic bomb. And we were really blessed to be the first authors to tell that whole story.
You know, people may wonder and think, my gosh, what would have happened if that ship had been torpedoed or attacked during that transport? It would have changed everything.
It would have. I mean, it certainly would have postponed quite a few things and maybe even resulted in the decision to invade Japan, the mainland. Because, you know, it would have taken several months to gain enough uranium to replace that had that bomb been lost. And that was part of the mission when they were charged with it, was this should be saved before everything else, because they knew that how long it would take to replace it. So there's no telling what might have happened should that have not made it to Tinian.
We're visiting with Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek. They are the authors of the book Indianapolis, the true story of the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history and the 50-year fight to exonerate an innocent man. After the bomb components were delivered, then they were going back, I guess, to the Philippines. Is that correct?
They delivered the bomb components to Tinian, then they stopped over at Guam, and then Captain McVeigh was to take the ship to the Philippines, as you say, on a routine mission. At that time, the southern part of the Philippine Sea was considered the backwater of the war, and McVeigh, who had been actually in the repair yards for a couple of months prior to this top-secret mission, asked around at Guam and said, "Hey, how are things out there in the Philippine Sea? Is it safe? I haven't been out here in a while." And the intelligence, the proactive intelligence that he got from a Commodore at the time said, "Hey, everything's safe, everything's quiet, Japan is on her last legs, there's nothing to worry about." The inactive intelligence that he got, in other words, intelligence that he did not receive, was that there was actually a group of four Japanese attack submarines that were headed south into the Philippine Sea directly toward Indianapolis's planned route in order to attack American ships.
I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in the movie of the USS Indianapolis, when they ask for what you just said, and then perhaps even escorts, they tell him, no, you can't have an escort because technically you don't even exist because you're not even supposed to be out there. Is that correct?
Unfortunately, not a lot of what was put into the film was actually accurate. You know, he did not ask directly for an escort, and I wasn't denied that's something that we were able to find in the research and even in his own testimony that he shares. But it wasn't because he didn't think he needed it. It was because he was reassured that there was absolutely no reason to ask for one.
And of course, as we know, as we read the book and listen to the book or watch the documentary that is available. And before I get on to that, did you write that documentary, Sarah?
Yes, I did. That was released in 2016, and we interviewed 104 of the survivors and rescue crew and family members.
And I would recommend, highly recommend, that you would watch that documentary before you watch the movie, as I mentioned earlier, and also read the book. It's Indianapolis by Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek. So getting back to where we were, okay, they drop off the components, they leave Guam, and they head out to sea, but suddenly something drastic happens.
Well, on July 30th, just a few minutes after midnight, the Japanese submarine I-58, which had been one of those four attack submarines headed south from Japan, the commander is Mochitsura Hashimoto. He decides to lie in wait at the intersection of several shipping lanes, and that intersection included the westbound shipping lane on which Indianapolis was traveling. Just after midnight, Hashimoto spots Indianapolis. He fires six torpedoes in a fan-like spread to account for whether Indianapolis was steering a zigzag course, which was an anti-submarine technique at the time. Indianapolis was, in fact, steering a straight course, and two of Hashimoto's torpedoes hit the ship. The first one blew off most of the bow, and so seawater began rushing in to the interior of the ship. The second torpedo hit just 2 seconds later, and it struck the ship at what we call amidships and ignited the ammunition stores. The vessel went down in 12 minutes. It went down by the head, which means bow first, and meanwhile it was listing crazily to starboard or to the right. So if you can imagine, it was going starboard, 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 but also its stern was lifting up into the sky. So by the time the ship plunged to the sea bottom, it looked like a 600-foot skyscraper there against the night sky. There were 1,195 men aboard. About 300 went down with the ship, and a little under 900 made it into the water alive.
And, of course, those 900 that made it into the water, that was just the beginning of their nightmare.
Yes.
Yeah, they would be in the water for 5 nights and 4 days, fighting the elements, fighting each other, and famously for, you know, the story, the sharks. You know, you also remember these men are covered in the fuel oil that was released from the ship when it sank. So this is thick, tar-like oil that can only be removed by heat. And so it's just stuck to them. And, you know, they're trying to breathe through this, and they're trying to swim. And, you know, of those roughly 900 men that went in the water, they believe there was only about 30 to 40 that were on a raft The rest were swimming or had life jackets or were on nets that had little cork floaters on it that barely kept them above the surface. So it wasn't, you know, just waiting on a raft for rescue. It was swimming for all these days.
You all mentioned at the beginning of earlier in the interview about the monologue from Jaws, where it talks about the sharks. And this is one of the things that these men were not aware of at the beginning, perhaps, but all of a sudden, there were a lot of sharks around them.
A lot of sharks. And in those days, the shark population was much bigger than it is today. And the Philippine Sea was incredibly clear, so they could see down through these crystal waters about 50 feet, and the men would describe not dozens or scores, but literally hundreds of sharks circling below them like tornadoes. And one of the most vivid shark attacks was related to us by a bosun's mate, second class, named Eugene Morgan. He was sitting on a raft or a floater net, and some yards away from him was a group of about 15 men sitting on another floater net, and all of a sudden, just a tornado of sharks attack that floater net, fins and froth and screams everywhere, and then suddenly there was nothing left. And so that was one of the most vivid shark attacks in my mind. But sharks would attack individually. Some of the men developed a technique for fighting them off. So, for example, this one sailor named Lyle Umenhofer, he discovered that if he would kick a shark hard in the flanks when that shark came by, the shark would be startled and dart away, but most of the men were not that lucky.
And of course, as the days progress, a lot of them didn't even have energy to lift up a leg, much less kick a shark in the flank.
Exactly. I mean, they hadn't had water or food for days. They've been swimming. The water at night, the temperatures would cause their body to drop, and then when the sun beat on them all day, it would rise, so a lot of fluctuation. And men began drinking salt water, and that, you know, leads to hallucination and a terrible, terrible way to die. So they're facing all this. Their buddies next to them are going through this. And really what was so important about telling this story properly was interviewing the rescue crews, because when it came to the fourth and fifth day, these men were so out of their minds, they didn't know what was happening around them. Few would have lived much more than another day, and it was just, they were really a breath away from death.
The men who were still able to think a little bit clearly, they discussed among themselves the danger of some of these men having hallucinations against each other?
That's right. And actually, none of the survivors for decades had told anyone about this until a couple of them confided in Sarah about what we now call the pact. And the pact was made among some reasonably sane men who realized that many of the men who were going out of their minds were attacking others, other innocent men. And it wasn't their fault. They had, you know, they had drunk seawater or they had gone insane from the lack of food and from exposure. And so they would hallucinate and they would think that their shipmates were maybe Japanese attackers and they would attack them and kill them or severely injure them. And so these men who made what we call the pact agreed that if another man became a threat to others, they would, in a humane way, execute him. And they didn't want to do it, but they realized that if they didn't do it, then none of them would survive.
Before the ship went down and after the attack, of course, the captain ordered that they send out an SOS signal. And some people may wonder, was that ever heard? Was it never heard? And then there's a part in the book about how I think it was Hashimoto who sent out a message that he had sunk a ship and the U.S. intercepted and thought that it might have been a trick.
Yeah, there were several men who, with their dying breath, worked very hard to get a signal out. Unfortunately, when the torpedo struck, the power went out on the ship. And so, you know, they did have generators, which they believe the signal went out, but there has not been any confirmation that they were ever received anywhere. We checked through the logbooks of, you know, later stories came out claiming that there were SOSs received, but when we looked in those logbooks from those commands, there was no record of it. So we don't have any confirmation, and we scoured all the records. There really is no evidence of any kind of cover-up, and in fact, it just wasn't something likely that would have been done at the time. So there's nothing that shows an SOS was received. However, you're correct. The transmission that was sent out by Hashimoto saying that he sunk a ship was received in multiple commands across the world even, and was dismissed as a trap. The Japanese at the time were known for luring Americans and, you know, allied ships to places where they would ambush them, saying, oh, this is an American ship, we need rescue, and then attacking upon arrival. So it was, you know, because the ship sank so quickly, there was no time for someone to radio back to the ship and say, can you confirm that you've been hit? The ship was already under the sea. But really, no one even investigated those reports other than to dismiss them initially.
Of course, these men had this on their minds for the rest of their lives, and including Captain McVeigh. And after they were rescued, after all this was said and done, perhaps people thought, well, they're okay now. But the battle continued in their minds because of guilt, because of how they felt for the rest of their mates who didn't make it. And then there was the situation where Captain McVeigh was court-martialed, but thanks to, gosh, I think it was a junior high boy who was working on something, came to the rescue?
Yes, Captain McVeigh was the only skipper in World War II to ever be court-martialed for losing his ship. And because of the lack of intelligence, because of incompetence on both sides of the Philippine Sea, because of complacency, there were many more people who should have been prosecuted or disciplined before they ever got to Captain McVeigh. As a result of that, the survivors, to a man, believed that their skipper had been wrongfully court-martialed. So really, beginning at their first reunion in 1960, they began fighting to restore the good name of Captain McVeigh. And that continued on for decades. The survivors would write letters to Congress. They would visit their congressmen. Captain McVeigh's sons did the same thing. But it wasn't until Hunter Scott, an 11-year-old boy, got involved that people, and this was already 1996 by this time, that interest, public interest in the exoneration of Captain McVeigh really came to the forefront. And then that effort was joined by a man named Captain Bill Todi, who was the skipper of the namesake submarine Indianapolis. Captain Todi also joined in the effort to exonerate Captain McVeigh. There were hearings held by the Senate Armed Services Committee in 1999, and finally Congress passed a resolution declaring their sense that Captain McVeigh was unfairly court-martialed. And then in 2001, Navy Secretary Gordon England ordered that entered into McVeigh's record. And so that quest to exonerate Captain McVeigh that began in 1960 was finally achieved in 2001.
Well, ladies, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today. And, of course, we just touched the subject, so you're going to have to read the book and then watch the documentary USS Indianapolis, The Legacy, which tells the entire story. And as I did, I would recommend that you read the book, but also listen to it, because something about someone telling you the story is just captivating, and you'll really learn a lot of things that I wasn't aware of. And thanks to Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek, who share with us in the book Indianapolis and also in the documentary USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Book Club on Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Book Club. I'm Luis Sainz.